looking at me for? I feel embarrassed. Well, good afternoon, brethren. It's been a wonderful, wonderful Feast of Tabernacles, has it not? Thoroughly enjoyed myself. My wife and I, quote, taken it easy. We enjoy doing that now. We're getting older. But I'm still a teenager at heart. I went up to Mr. Fred Carew just before the services started, and I said, "Fred, get out your sermon. I've changed my mind." And he went... Well, the choir sounded absolutely beautiful, and all of the music has been beautiful, and thoroughly enjoyed the friendship and the camaraderie that we have as people. You know, you can walk around without fear. No one's going to steal your wallet, steal your car, steal your wife, or anything else that will move. And it's just wonderful to be at a peaceful place where God's people are gathered together. This Feast of Tabernacles, I think, has been a memorable one for me, particularly because I've been asked to speak twice. I was very honored about that. And I said, what on earth am I going to talk about the second time? Because I knew that, you know, all the good scriptures are going, Revelation 20, check that one off, and Ezekiel 24, or 31, or 46, or 108, whatever chapter it was, we'll check that one off too, and on and on and on. So what is there left to talk about? The last great day, the millennium, this incredible period of time and understanding we have as human beings. Before I get into my sermon, I'd like to say thank you very much indeed to our leader, who has taken and borne the brunt of the work here, Mr. Jeff Richards. I've done festival coordinator myself on two or three occasions, and it is a lot of work and a lot of organisation, and you need good support, and I'm not aware that anything has indeed gone wrong. So thank you for all your work, Mr. Richards. And the crew, everyone that served, thank you very much. The speakers, all very, very well prepared presentations. And as my background is in communication and I taught speech at Ambassador College and focused on that in my master's degree, I appreciate the organization of thought and the structure that goes into what people say. Just like to mention John Safarik for a moment. I know others have as well. And Marsha knew John and Sandy for many years. They were in the band in Ambassador College together. And over the years, we've crossed paths. And we had a conversation just down here a couple of days ago. And when he walked onto the stage to give the closing prayer, Marsha said to me, "You know, he doesn't look well." And we had had a chat, and indeed he was not well. But what was interesting, he said that he had been in a master's degree program in counseling. And he had got through with very, very high marks. And his professor said to him, "Look, we'd like you to go on for a PhD. And it shows John's heart, because he said, "No, I don't want to do that. And I don't want to do it because I want to take the information I've learned to help my brethren." And that was a wonderful servant's heart, and indeed he did that. So I'm very pleased to say that in one sense I'm envious of him. He's no more struggles, no more trial, no more trouble. We who are left behind have those struggles and those trials and those troubles, and they will come and go, as they do in everyone's life. And he's made it, so I'm kind of envious. But he's a wonderful man and a great servant. Now, I'm going to speak about a topic that I've never heard discussed before. I like to come out of left field, because I know that typically we have a certain, shall I say, patois in the Church of God. And how many times can you talk about the Last Great Day or the Feast of Tabernacles, yada, yada, yada. So you have to, in my mind, try to come at something a little different. I want to talk to you about assimilation. That's the title, just one word, assimilation. I am an immigrant. How many people here are immigrants to the United States? Would you raise your hand? A few people. Then you will understand what I'm saying. Anyone will immediately know when I speak that I'm not a native-born American. You'd have to be as thick as two short planks to draw another conclusion. And they have to say a couple of words and bingo, you don't come from here, do you? No, sir, I sure don't. I arrived in the United States in 1980 with two children, two boys. They were 8 and 10 years old. I'd been pastoring three churches in the Midlands of England, Nottingham, only we say Nottingham, Northampton, and Birmingham. And very sadly, my wife had contracted malignant melanoma and had passed away. So it was decided that I should come to America for 1 year on a, in quotes, sabbatical. On my way to America, I went via Australia, where my wife came from, and took back some private belongings that I thought her mother and father and brother would like to have. And while I was there, I received a phone call, and my sabbatical changed to, well, would you work for us at the college? So I said, well, yeah, I guess, you know, we're here to serve. So I accepted to do something. I had no idea what they wanted me to do, but I decided to sure I'd go ahead. So I changed my visa in short shift from a student visa to a green card, understanding that with at the end of the year that I would be going back. What I did not know was that before the end of that year, I was supposed to become emotionally attracted to a young female of some age and go back with a wife. Now, I didn't know that. Nobody told me that. Now, here I was, you know, not long bereaved and going through the course of bereavement and all of the emotional ups and downs, taking care of two children. The famous words that stick out in my memory from my two kids. Not very tasty, Dad. That was the cooking. My first wife was a cordon bleu cook. She really loved cooking. So I was wandering around in my world of misery for a couple of years because it just took me about 3 years to get through bereavement. And then Mr. Raymond McNair, who had married me and my first wife, Joyce, called me up and said, Arthur, will you come up here and help me out on the fourth floor? The fourth floor being significant because there were only four floors, and each corner building office was important because biggies, you know, took care of those. Mr. Armstrong was one, treasurer the other, Raymond McNair was the other, and facilities manager, Mr. Laravia, he was in the other one. So I was in one of the biggie offices, but really a very small fish in the bowl. And over time, I gradually got to the place where I felt like dating. You know, it's embarrassing being 40-odd years old with two children trying to date. I certainly wasn't going to look down into the student body, as one notable person suggested, who will remain nameless. And so one day I got up the courage to talk to the young lady sitting over there. She said, yes. Okay. Very nice. It was quite embarrassing getting through that move. And very kindly. She was very sweet and kind to me, and I appreciated that very much. So much so that we've been together now for 34 years. And I asked her some questions. I said, I'm an international. I don't know how long I'll be in America. Can you stand my British peculiarities and idiosyncrasies? And she said, yes, she would. I said, well, you know, we might go international again, you know, I just don't know. And here she was, a farm girl from South Texas, go down Mount 72 south of Corpus Christi, as I call it. Only it really should be Corpus Soggy. Down into Mosquitosville, cockroach territory, javelinas, and she was not used to being international. Very stable family in South Texas, farming people. And here I had been jogging around the world to England and Australia and here to the States. And at the senior citizens meeting or fun we had, I put up my hand when they asked the question, and I've got it here. Who has been to the most foreign countries? And some people put up their hands, and so I put up mine. I said, I think it's about 38. And then I went back, and for those of you who can see, I wrote down the countries that I had been to one way or another, and I came to 41. So I've seen a lot of the world, and it's been a great privilege to do so. And going international, I realized for my potential wife, or when she became my wife, would be very, very difficult. She'd never lived internationally. She didn't speak like an international. All y'all. And so, when she said, yes, I would go international, I made a decision. I decided that if she was going to be willing to go international, I would become an American citizen. And having made that decision, having lived abroad and traveled and so forth, and seen a lot of this world and the poverty and sadness that it really is, I decided to become an American citizen. I had to go through a legal process. I had to learn and understand the Constitution of the United States. 25 lessons in citizenship. I studied the structure of this nation, how the government was put together, and learned all about it. I studied that booklet, and then I had to have a medical examination. And thankfully, they didn't test this. I was interviewed after that on the structure and laws of the United States. And one day, I went down on the 13th of October 1988 to the city of Los Angeles with 10,000 other people and made my oath of allegiance to the United States of America. At the conclusion of that process, I was given a letter from President Ronald Reagan on that 13th of October, which I have brought with me today. Here it is. Now, of course, it's a form letter. But I would like to read this to you, because it has a great deal to do, really, with what we are about. Dear fellow American, it is a distinct privilege to congratulate you and warmly welcome you as a new citizen of the United States of America. Today, by choice, you formally embraced America as your new home. In so choosing, you are now part of the greatest country in the world, a land of extraordinary natural beauty, a land of strength and pride, a land of God's precious grace and glory, This is our America. For from this day forward, you will share in the blessings of liberty and freedom that we, as Americans, have enjoyed for more than two centuries. With those cherished blessings come privilege, responsibility, and one of America's greatest gifts, opportunity. So I ask you to give America your hearts and all of your energies. Join in our effort to defend and keep her as the promise of our generation, tomorrow's generation, and generations to come. Together in common purpose and faith, we will keep America strong and free. God bless you today and always. Welcome home. What a wonderful welcome to America. Presiding at that swearing-in was Judge William J. Roe. And he said this. I took the notes on the back of my paperwork. For many, this has been a long, tedious process. I hope you notice how I said that word. Today does not end our struggle. You must protect freedom and a happy life. President Roosevelt said, be able and willing to pull your weight. You have been granted a franchise of voting. I urge you to use that vote. We are a country of laws, not men. Learn those laws and be informed and make a wise decision. Keep in mind, you are all free to do as you wish to do without people ordering you around. Keep your country clean and free from graffiti. Pay your taxes honestly, because if you don't, you shift the load to someone else and face criminal penalties. And then he went on to say, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face. The rains fall soft upon your fields until we meet again. May God hold you in the palm of his hand. Did I feel welcome? Most certainly I did. He finished off by saying, that was a traditional Gaelic blessing I just read, it is great to have you join us as citizens. I am sure you will fulfill your destiny to its greatest. I have been now a law-abiding citizen for 29 years. I have married an American. My children have become American citizens. They in turn have married American wives. And now we have, five American grandchildren. I have assimilated into American culture to a degree. I say to a degree, not from want or desire, but how do you change your native accent? How do you take something and change it in a way that you're totally different in the way you speak? I'm sort of halfway house place. You know, an island in the middle of the Atlantic between Europe and the States. Because when I talk to people in England, I can hear the difference. They sound strange to me. You might find that funny, but they do. And I slip into saying things in the American way. Process. I'll take a rain check. It's in the ballpark of. And these terms that we accept for granted mean absolutely nothing to the people that I'm speaking to. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll check with you later. Oh, I'll talk to you later. I'll call you later. Something like that. And change what I was saying. So I've kind of moved over in many ways, because I look at feet and yards and inches, dollars and cents, whereas Europe looks at meters and decimalization over there, the way they have it. And I have assimilated gently into the culture of America. I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. This country has been fabulously blessed. And having seen the poverty in India and Africa, and many other countries I could name, I know how blessed we are as a nation. God has blessed us in this nation. But what does it mean to assimilate? And what on earth has that got to do with the last great day? Noah Webster, the lexicographer, that is a person who writes and makes dictionaries, in his 1828 Dictionary of the English Language, he is also known as the father of education in America, he defines assimilation as to become similar, to become converted into like substance. And assimilation is the act of bringing to a resemblance. So, in a sense, that being here, you automatically gradually merge into becoming more American for an Englishman, or if you go to Europe, you would go the other way. Noah Webster's great, 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 how many grandchildren, Merriam-Webster, in his ninth New Collegiate Dictionary in 1989, changed the definition a little bit. He said, to take in and absorb into the system. We eat food, we take it in, we absorb it in of our body, it becomes part of us. That is assimilation. Secondly, to take into the mind and thoroughly comprehend. So you intellectually connect with what you are reading or studying as far as religious terms are concerned. We intellectually inculcate into our minds information. And thirdly, to absorb into a cultural tradition of a population and group. So here we are, all foreigners in one way, but all united in another way. How many of you have considered being absorbed or comprehended or become part of the culture of God? I pause because haven't we been asked to do this the same way that I was asked to do this, to become a citizen of the United States? Have we not all been called in a similar fashion? I can prove I'm a member of the country. Here's my original certificate. And I look younger then. The United States of California, Central District, 1988, October 13th. You know, we have a calling, brethren, but do we realize that we are in a process of assimilation? We are in a process of taking into ourselves God's standards, God's values, God's mentality, and becoming part of us. Now, it's an intellectual, mental thing, I understand, but did we not do this voluntarily? Well, we were called, but then we had to make the move. Have we not been commissioned to embrace a spiritual home? Another home from really the one we live in this physical world. God's values and his laws, and what does he say? You've got to obey me in my home. You've got to obey me. Have we been commissioned to learn a new way of thinking and being? Thinking and being. Both. Have we been commissioned to migrate from the world into a mentality of the kingdom of God? We have been commissioned to assimilate God's values and standards and ways. In John chapter 14, Jesus said, I've got it typed out in my notes, verse 6, John 14, 6. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father except through me. The exception clause is, as a result of my sacrifice, you can come to my dad. As a result of your repentance, you can come to my dad. There is no other way to do that. And to do that, we must assimilate. Now, I want to turn to the example of the Apostle Paul, because Paul really was a remarkable individual. But Paul, or Saul, had a problem. Saul, still breathing, Acts 9, verses 1 and 2 here, Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked for letters from him to the synagogues of Damascus, so that if he found any who were of the way we should be following, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. Okay, I'm going to move a little bit. Let me ask you a question. What do you think of Paul or Saul? What do you think of him? Was he hard-hearted? Was he calloused? Was he cruel? Was he dogmatic? Opinionated? All of those things. Why? Well, because Saul was an incredibly intelligent individual. Saul had memorized Torah, the first five books, by the age of 12. Saul had sat at the feet of Gamaliel. And it was on the road to Damascus that a 2x4 landed on Saul's head to wake him up. That was the only thing that he could do, to be woken up. A blindness of light, a lack of speech, the inability to talk, dumb, the great orator, the knowledgeable man. And he was silent. And he heard a voice. That voice said something to him, if I can put it in modern English. Saul, you're in the way. Saul, you ain't doing the way. Saul, you're persecuting the way. So get out of the way. That's modern English of Saul. Saul, you're persecuting me. You're a blockhead, Saul. I admire your drive. I admire your tenacity. I admire your strength. I admire your mind. But. And that but is a big one. That but is a big one. You need to get on the right track. Pharisaical Judaism is one which I'll very, very briefly describe. When Moses was given the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai, the Pharisees believed that the oral law was given to them as well. So every rabbi who is a senior rabbi now, today, has passed down decisions for the Jewish community who are Orthodox Jews. And so we have this huge Talmud of do's and don'ts. And so Paul was one of those. He did everything right from morning to night. But he did not learn to assimilate with his human being, his fellow man. Paul was an isolated individual in a relatively small group of people. And he didn't assimilate. He was special. Now our job here, brethren, is to learn the way. To assimilate. To be the product. And we, like Paul, are in training. In the way, as exampled by Jesus Christ. And the purpose is to become mentors and trainers and comforters to people who have been deceived by Satan over the millennium. We're here to learn a huge lesson. We're here to be something. A product of God's way of life. In Jeremiah 16, verses 9 through 21, it says this, O Lord, my strength, Jeremiah 16, 19 through 21, and my fortress, my refuge in the day of affliction. The Gentiles shall come to you from the ends of the earth and say, surely our fathers have inherited lies, worthless and unprofitable things. Would a man make gods for himself, which are no gods? Therefore, behold, I will this once cause them to know. I will cause them to know my hand, my might, and they shall know my name is the Lord. Now you think about the number of people out of all of history who have lived and died who have been lied to, who have been taught falseness, who did not understand. Many people today, as I use the analogy, enter into Christianity in the middle of the movie. They don't take any notice of the Old Testament. I want to recommend, if you really want to study into deceit and lying, a series of five CDs by a gentleman called Richard Reeves, R-I-V-E-S. He does an amazing job of going around the Middle East and showing the development from the early New Testament church and how very quickly it got off course. And he documents it time after time after time. And he, in his introduction to the series, said, you know, several years ago I started studying and I looked at many things and I came to realize that everything I've been taught in my Christian walk up to this point has been lies. It's not even in the Bible. And that's astonishing. Now, this person has nothing to do with us or that, but it's a wonderful piece of information which, if you really want to go down that road, is very beneficial. Now, we're given a task of developing character and living and following the example of Jesus Christ. Why? Because he is the way. He is the example. And I've used this before. Someone reminded it to me. I gave in the sermon, WWJD, what would Jesus do? Is misleading. I don't need to know what would he do. I know what he did. And there's a big difference. WDJD, what did Jesus do? And ever since the early second century, when Christianity went off course, and a new gospel and a new method was called, of course, Catholicism, became Catholicism, the further they went so far off course, the further away they got from anything of the true Messiah, the true sacrifice and the meaning of it. So, at this time, I need to put on a new pair of glasses. These are my theological glasses. You've got to have these glasses on to really be able to read properly the Bible. And so, excuse me a second. Okay, better stop that. We're on the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther. We had a wonderful number of articles in the Beyond Today, which pointed out that Martin Luther was an anti-Semite, that he wrote his thesis, allegedly, and he was a brave man, no doubt, stood up to what was the Catholic powers of the time. But the result of this one degree off course from true north, we now have approximately 33,800 different Christian organizations around the world. 33,800 and it's probably more by now. And Christianity is in chaos and confusion. And when someone says to you, why do you do what you do? Where do you start? Where do you start? Remember what Jeremiah said in chapter 16? Surely our fathers have inherited lies, worthless and unprofitable things. Can you possibly consider billions of people that have been born since creation? You know, we don't know how many actual human beings have ever been born because we have no way of knowing that. There's absolutely no demographic data available for 99% of humanity's time on Earth. No one knows. I can tell you that they estimate it's about 108 billion, with a big B, billion people. I can't imagine that many people. 108 billion approximately. And yet at the same time, we're self-destructing because as we look at the United States abortion clock, as of September 15, we're murdering since 1973 and the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, we've murdered 60 million babies. 60 million. I find it hard to believe a Christian nation would do that. The United States has Planned Parenthood, and since 1970, nearly 8 million babies have been murdered. The total for this year alone, 700,000 babies. Do we grieve? Think of our African-American babies. Since 1973, almost 18 million of them have been aborted and murdered. It's shocking. It's shocking. That's almost the population of Southern California, short of 5 million. Can you believe that? If you've been to Southern California, it's hard to believe. It's hard to believe. And yet, you know, the reason why I'm doing this is not to make you feel bad, but to put your minds in the position of saying, what if? What if all of those babies and all of those people who have been born in the past come up at one time? How are we going to handle that? You know, take one war statistic. My grandfather died of mustard gassing, World War I. But let's take World War I. Total number of military and civilian casualties of World War I was more than 41 million. And on top of that, there was another 23 million injured. Now, we've had wars after wars after wars. That's just one statistic to make the point. I'm asking you a question about assimilation. How many students here? How many students sitting right here now will there be in the great white throne judgment? Each and every one of us, I beg you to look at it from the point of view of you're going to be a mentor and a teacher. That's your task. Be a mentor and a teacher. I can see billions of people coming up. In a world that's had 1,000 years to reforest, to make good and clean and bright under the government of 1,000 years of God. And I can see all of those people coming up at one time. Well, I'm assuming, I don't know, maybe it's only 100 years if we got that right. It's a good sort of marker. How many people are going to, you know, can you imagine 18 billion? It's beyond imagination. It's beyond comprehension. But that is the harvest that I look as though I am training for, and I'm encouraging you to look at this day as a training momentum, as a something that you can conceptualize and believe and understand that this is what you'll be doing at this time. Working with people for 100 years. That's all. Not very long. My children went to, my grandchildren went to a school called Darlington School, and its motto was this: help us reach hearts so that we may teach minds. Help us reach hearts so that we may teach minds. You see, this is an emotional plea. This is an emotional plea. You have to get to someone's heart. You have to touch their emotions in order for them to be willing to learn and grow. And some people have been through a very, very difficult period of time. Reaching people's hearts has to do with what I did when I came into the United States. I had to learn new stuff. I had to learn the Constitution. I had to understand my responsibilities as a citizen, and I had to swear that I would do that. And it takes reaching hearts in a godly government and environment. So we are going to be dealing with cultures that span 6,000 years. There are people that would look at us like we're from Mars, who were born 2,000 years ago, or go back way to the very beginning. And the last great day is the only theology that explains the future and opportunity. Indeed, as Mr. Beeves was saying this morning, we're going to have to deal with people and explain how and why are we doing this in a culture that is totally strange to them. There, I believe it's going to be necessary for a healing of the mind. I believe that God's going to have to work with these people who have been damaged, who have been blown up, who have been aborted, who died because of persecution. 60 million Russians died in the Gulag archipelago. 60 million. Now, we could go on and on and on and on with figures and numbers, and it just becomes meaningless. But can we envision looking at people through those eyes of persecution, of torture and trial and tribulation, and beginning to work with them in a manner that is suitable? The United States have forgotten about assimilation. The United States stopped people coming into this country for two generations. The reason why they did that was because the Italians and the people that came over from Italy and France and other countries into the United States came over speaking their language. And when we went to the Statue of Liberty and walked around and visited Ellis Island, it was a story on the earphones about a man, and he was Italian, spoke American by now. He talked about his family coming down to the train to go to America, to a new life. And Grandma came with him. And Grandma got on the train, and she walked through the carriage and got off. The family got on, the train started moving, and I said, "Where's Grandma?" On the station. We have forgotten about assimilation because that generation and the next generation and the next generation, three generations, to assimilate and become American. Today we've forgotten that. This is my Kaiser Permanente multi-language interpreter services. They speak English, I'm glad to hear that. Spanish, Chinese, Vietnamese, Tagalog, Korean, Russian, Japanese, Amharic, German, Achtung, French, Farsi, Arabic, Yoruba, Kushite, Oromo, and Nepali. We're not assimilating. We are accommodating. And the United Kingdom is making the same mistake. We have 19 no-go areas where Sharia law is enforced in England. And you know, brethren, our job is to assimilate. And I want to encourage you to look more towards the basics and the foundation of the Old Testament a little bit. You cannot understand the two great commandments, love God and love man, as in Matthew 22, Mark chapter 12, and Luke chapter 10, without comprehending the context of that in its original giving. Assimilation is taking in and the information becoming a part of you. It is your health, it is your mind, it is your thinking, it's your behavior. And I might ask the question, how are you doing now? How have you got on this feast? Has there been an argument in your family? Have you learned the law of love? Have you learned the law of patience? Have you learned the law of kindness, of sympathy, and so on. In those references of the great two principles, you may read them in Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verses 1 through 9, and Leviticus 19:18, verses 9 through 18. Go back and read the original. Go back to the beginning of the movie. Go back and look at what we should be and how we should behave in the objective sense. And I'm now going to look at the emotional sense. In the emotional sense. Look with me, please, to Zephaniah chapter 3. Zephaniah chapter 3 and verse 8. I've got Zechariah, but not the right Z. All right, Zephaniah chapter 3. Because we have to start somewhere. Wait a minute, I'm losing it. Let me get the right page here. Go to the beginning of the book. Find the word Z, Zephaniah, page 1046. Okay, here we go. We're going the right way now. 1046 in the New King James Version, after Habakkuk. All right, chapter 3 and verse 8. We have to begin somewhere. I have heard the approach... Oh, sorry, that's chapter 2. Hang on, I'll get it right. Chapter 3, verse 8. The faithful remnant. Therefore, wait for me, says the Lord, until the day I rise up for plunder. My determination is to gather the nations to my assembly of kingdoms. Plural. Going to be a lot of people around in this time. To pour out my indignation or my fierce anger, and the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy, for then I will restore unto the peoples a pure language. Of course, it's going to be English. I hope you know that. Then I will restore to the peoples a pure language, and they may all call on the name of the Lord. You know, this summer, my wife and eldest son and daughter-in-law and two grandchildren were in Italy for 3 weeks. And we went to a villa in Tuscany. Tuscany is a beautiful area, hilly, grapes, olives, idyllic. There was a German gentleman there and his wife, and they were on their 50th anniversary. And they had come down to this villa several times, and our eldest son and his wife had been there several times as well. We had a nice meal outside on the countryside, and we toasted congratulations on 50 years of marriage. And the next day, we happened to be walking past each other, and he looked at me and he said, "You know, I have studied English business all my life, and I still don't understand English." Think of it. Think of it. The difficulty, and it's going to have to be a miracle, of having one pure language. Think of the difficulties we have in international relationships today. How things are misunderstood because they just don't have a concept for the word you're using. So then, I will restore the peoples a pure language. This is going to be God's language. That they may all call upon the name of the Lord to serve him with one accord from beyond the rivers of Euphrates, Ethiopia. Many worshippers and daughters of my displaced ones shall bring my offering. In that day you shall not be shamed for any of your deeds which you transgress against me, for then I will take them away from your midst. And those who rejoice in your pride, you shall no longer be haughty in my holy mountain. The miracle is going to have to be worked, I believe, by the Father and the Son with people, is to remove embarrassment, to remove the problems and trials that they've had, and give them a starting point at where we can actually begin to teach and instruct in the way of God. It may not have to be a Pauline moment, of a 2x4 and blindness, and totally lost power. It'll be a lot more gentler than that, I believe. And it's in the mode of Deuteronomy chapter 10. If you'll turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 10. Now, I claim that Deuteronomy is the converted book of the Bible. You say, what do you mean by that? You know, Abel, the fourth human being in creation, is going to be in the resurrection. It's interesting, isn't it? What did Abel do? Or what did he know that Cain didn't know or do? Simple, obey me. Obey me. So there must have been some instruction. We're not giving those details. But obviously, God doesn't hold people accountable for what he doesn't inform them about. And so he's informed them about what was necessary. And Abel will be in the resurrection, Hebrews 11. And a lot of other people. We don't know how many. It doesn't say. But there's a lot of people will be in that first resurrection. We each have to have this knowledge and this understanding, and all humanity will have to have this knowledge and this understanding. And now Israel, chapter 10 and verse 12. And now Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? Fear. Oh, well, it's calm. You can't do that. You'll hurt my feelings. No, you've got to fear me. That means respect and have awe for me. Fear the Lord your God. Walk in all his ways. We've been called to do that. And sometimes new people have difficulty. I know I did. I ended up in the brig in the Royal Navy for a month for my pains of keeping the Sabbath. Wasn't funny. They made it as unpleasant as possible to keep the Sabbath. So I said, okay. So they shaved my head, took away all my pay, put me in a cell with a wooden board and one blanket, weren't allowed to wash for a week, took us around an assault course every morning, 9.5 Lee Enfield rifle until you're dropping down like this, because they wanted to make it so unpleasant that you would give in. Well, at the end of the month, the captain of the brig called me in and said, okay, we think you're sincere. You can purchase your way out of the Navy, and it will be £175. And at the rate of 5 to 1, that was a heck of a lot of money. I sold everything I had. My mother got some money from somewhere and gave it to me, and we got it out. I had £10. I got on a train from Portsmouth to Hayling Island, where we were keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. And I observed the feast. And it was an amazing thing. Dr. Benjamin Ray, long passed away, came up to me and said, do you want to go to Ambassador College? I had no job. I didn't think I was bright. I had no skills. I could do whippings and lashings. I could sail boats. I could shoot rifles. I could tie knots. I could do semaphore and Morse code. I could do all the things that were totally useless in the religious community. I could run. I could jump. I could swim. This stuff, no idea. I had opportunity. Opportunity. The opportunity to obey God's way. It was a start. It was a beginning. And I had fear for the Lord. And I did begin to walk in his way in 1963. The day I got out of the brig began the Feast of Tabernacles. I kind of like to think that God planned it that way. And so we walk in all his ways, and to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments of the Lord your God and his statutes which I command you for your good today. You see, this is obedience. On the date I got my certificate of citizenship. I was no longer a British subject. I was a citizen, and there's a big difference. It was remarkable to me when this room of 10,000 people, and people were getting up, walking over here and getting over, and they would call out the person, "Would the man in the red Scottish hat there please go and sit down in the seat? Or would that lady in the red dress there, would she go over and sit down? Don't move. We don't want you to move." And here were people doing this. I'm saying, they're not even obedient to a request of the process that was going on for their citizenship. What hope have we? See, simple obedience, we just knowing to obey. And let's go on. Indeed, the heaven, verse 14, and the high heavens belong to the Lord your God, also the earth with all that is in it. The Lord your God delights only in your fathers to love them. He chose their descendants after them above all peoples as it is this day. Therefore, circumcise the foreskin of your heart. Know what that means? It's not about male. It's not about female. It's about all you all. Everything one of us here. This is conversion. And we need that conversion in order to pass it along to a generation of people who suddenly come up out of the grave, however it's going to happen. Everything imaginable possible has been done to human beings by other wretched individuals. They're going to come up, and we're going to be there, however many it needs, however many it takes. I'm sure God's not going to make a mistake in counting the numbers. Hey, how are you doing? Where'd you come from? What's your name? When were you born? And begin to build a relationship as a spirit being, with a physical human being, that now is in a totally disoriented place. Totally unfamiliar with this world. Their micro world in their world was as far as a donkey day's ride. And we get on a plane and fly 6,000 miles. We put people into space. NASA is planning to put someone on Mars. It's unbelievable. Today we have one language. First time since Genesis chapter 11. And God destroyed that nation. Why? It was going somewhere he didn't want it to go. Today we have one language. Did you know that? It's computers. Computers. I just wonder, as I look at some of these things, where we are. And maybe that tipping point, that time when we've gone far enough, is where we are. And so I'm encouraging you, brethren, circumcise the foreskin of your heart and be stiff-necked no longer. The example this morning in the sermon was tragic, where the woman was so hard-hearted. We don't need hard-hearted people. We need kind, understanding, not stupid, but people who can identify because of the experience we're going through now, today, in our lives, our problems, that we can look forward to a time when we can work with individuals and you can say, you know what, I understand. I understand. I don't know exactly your experience, but I understand. Because our God, as it says in verse 17, the Lord your God is a God of gods, the Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and takes no bribe. He administers justice for the fatherless and the widow and the stranger. A man was talking to me today who had been treated unjustly. And he said, I stayed away from church for several years. Managing injustice. Have you experienced injustice? I know I have, twice in the Church of God. I resigned over it from employment in the Church of God. I said to the administrators at the time, I will not work for an organization that does not follow the scripture. And my wife and I went out and got work and survived. We have got to be committed, brethren, to justice. What did he say? The weightier matters of the law are justice, mercy, and faith. And he goes on to say in verse 19, love the stranger, for you were strangers in Egypt. Love the stranger. So when we look at the lesson today that I'm trying to drive across, is what we are doing today is training us for tomorrow. How are you doing? Does the motto of the school help us to reach hearts so that we may teach minds? Would you write it down? Help us to reach hearts. You see, bottom line, it's an emotional connection that we have to have with other people. Learning is more than filling your head with facts. Learning is about understanding. Understanding. And if life ceases when the heart stops, doesn't life begin when the heart begins to beat? So how can humanity destroy that godly potential life? We're here, brethren, on a great, great crusade. We'll only have 100 years, once again, if we've got it right. I'm negotiable on that point, but we don't know. But it says it, doesn't it? That allows for 4 generations, which is enough time for assimilation and enculturation to take place. I hope that you will be a teacher in the great white throne judgment. That is the greatest harvest of humanity that will ever be. Because after that, as we learned this morning, or we know, the end comes, Satan is released, some dunderheads will refuse to accept God's way, and will have to perish. After that, time stops, and eternity begins. It's an incredible story. Modern Christianity doesn't teach this, but we do. So I hope and pray that when you leave today at the end of the service, you go with a mission in your mind to learn, to know, to understand, to develop patience, to be kind and considerate. These are the qualities that we will need when dealing with people who haven't experienced that, and there will be billions of them.